A, May the 2nd, 1983, Monday, 5 o'clock p.m., Hearing Room A, Senate Committee on Energy and Environment, Senator John Kitzhaber, Chairman, Vice Chairman Stephen Starkovich, Hearing and Possible Work Session on Senate Bill 237.
On Senate Bill 318.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Day.
I move we rescind the amendments dated 4-12-83 to Senate Bill 318. And the amendments were dated Senate Bill 318-1 from Legislative Council. We'll have to move to rescind those in order to correct a deficiency we have.
Okay. If you will recall, I'll accept the motion. Senator Day moves that we rescind the previous amendments to Senate.
I have a new set to make, and I think it's the fastest way to make it.
And if you recall, there was some question as to whether or not the language did what we thought it would do. And we'd added the language notification to all parties as a public announcement at each public meeting in which the subject matter of ex parte contact is to be considered. Is there any objection to rescinding those amendments? Okay. So I ordered.
Mr. Okay. Chairman, would you? I would move wait a minute. I know where you want. Let's get this done. I'd like to move amendments to Bill 318-2, dated 4/29/83. Please.
It's all in your materials here if you want.
Senator.
Thank you, Chief. I have to grab a quorum when I can get it.
I know.
I'll be right back.
You got that. Not that first. Hooked on.
This was really the suggested language, Mr. Chairman. That.
Okay. Todd, why don't you run over what we're doing here?
We had the 318-1 amendments talk about notice to parties of an ex parte communication and their right to rebut its substance on the record. It wasn't clear what we meant by notification. The amendments 318-2 clarify that. Notice means a public announcement of the content of the communication and of the party's right to rebut the substance of the communication, and that that would be made at each hearing where the action will be considered or taken.
Okay, Attorney. Senator Day has moved the adoption of legislation 382. Is there any discussion? I'll give you time to look them over.
The parties that requested the bill, I believe, have acquiesced in these amendments.
That's true, Mr. Chairman. We agree to them.
That looks all right. Okay. There's no objection. Those are adopted.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 318 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Day moves amended Senate Bill 318 to the desk. Do pass recommendation and request to the President that the subsequent referral to Trade and Economic Development be rescinded. I have a letter from Senator Gardner acquiescing to that action. Yes. I did. Clerk, call a roll. Is there any discussion on that? Okay, clerk, call a roll, please.
Senator Day?
Aye.
Senator Roberts?
Aye.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator
Kitzhaber. Aye. And if the subsequent rule of trade is rescinded, Senator Day can carry that down.
Okay.
Okay. Now we will go into the last hearing on, next to the last hearing, Senate Bill 327. And today we're dealing with the portions of the bill that have to do with changing assessment. And I'd like to have Peterson come up first from the Department of Revenue and run through what the impact of that is.
My name is Rick Peterson. I'm from Legislative Revenue. You sure we're talking about the same thing? You said 327,
I'm sorry, it's 237.
Okay.
Sorry. We still may not be talking about the same thing, but that's the right number.
All right, got the right number.
You have the right numbers, they're just a little rearranged.
Rearranged,
definitely. You keep you guys around to anticipate. Did you ever done that?
All I'm prepared to do now is to make a few comments about the kinds of changes that are here to deal with taxation of farmland. Okay. And basically what I'm going to do is talk about a number of points starting on page 11 of the Payne Gross version of the bill. And probably the most important thing this does is it provides two classifications of lands that can get a special tax treatment. Farmland in exclusive farming zones and this marginal agricultural land that's defined earlier in the bill. Currently, land that is not...
Excuse me, could I have the... If people want to talk back there, just say to sit out in the hall, please. We've had a little trouble hearing you. Thank you, everybody. Okay, should you continue, please?
Okay, currently land that is not in an exclusive farm use zone can get the special farm use treatment if it is used for farmland. Okay. If you make this change, basically line 10 on page 11, what you're doing is requiring the land that is not an exclusive farm use zone to be in this marginal lands zone to get the farm use assessment. Okay, and given the definition of marginal lands, I'm not prepared yet to make any kind of statement about how much land we're talking about there. It's kind of difficult to tell. Okay, so it could be a significant amount of land that will be removed from farm use assessment. Okay. The other change of significance is there's an income test placed on farms in exclusive farm use zones, a $500 gross income test that is not currently in the law. Okay. In conjunction with this income test, there's been a yearly application required by both farms in and out of the EFUs. Okay. So... page 12, lines 10 and 11, that's the $500 income requirement, gross income requirement for farms and EFUs. Okay. There was a number of years ago, and I'm not quite sure what the date was, but there was, in years past, a $500 gross income test for farms and EFUs, and then it was removed from the law. Okay, the income test that currently is required for non-EFU farms is now applicable to the marginal situation. Okay. The income test then means that you have a yearly requirement for application from the EFU zone farmland that didn't exist before. Okay. They were just zoned in EFUs and they got farm use assessment without application. Okay, in conjunction with the income test is a couple of issues that are sort of sensitive in the world of special farm assessments. And that has to do with the land under the dwellings and also the wasteland on the farm. In lines 17 through 26, we're talking about land under the dwellings in farm use and the wasteland. Now, under the current law, if you are in a non-zone farmland area and you're getting farm assessment and more than half of your gross income comes from the farm, then the land under the dwelling is assessed at farm use value, and the wasteland in your farm area is assessed at farm use value. The way that this is written now, those two requirements will also go for land in the EFU zones. That is, currently if you're in the EFU zone, the land under the dwelling is farm use assessment. Okay? The way things are changed here, it's going to require over half the income of the farmer to get the farm use assessment. Okay. Now, and also that same comment is true for the wasteland here. Now, there appears to be a conflict with ORS 215.203, which specifically allows farms in EFUs to have wasteland and land under the buildings as at farm use value. So there, you may have to have legislative council look at, make sure that there's not a conflict here. Okay. All right. Then the next item of importance is at the bottom of page 14 and the top of page 15. This deals with the additional tax. Now, the additional tax, sometimes people call it the penalty, but in the law it's called the additional tax, is a tax that becomes due when the farmland changes its use. If you're farming the land, you get special farm taxation consideration, and then you change the use of the land and no longer farm it, then there's some additional tax that becomes due. And before the law was changed a couple of sessions ago, they actually kept track of exactly how much the tax benefit you received and made you pay that back plus interest. Now it's calculated on a system where they keep track of the number of years under the special farm assessment, and then they multiply the benefit in the most recent year times the number of years you had the special farm taxation treatment, okay, up to a maximum number. So if you've been getting farm use assessment for 3 years and you change the use of the land, then you'd have to pay three times the benefit in the most recent year.
That's current law, Mr. Chairman.
That's current law. And if you're in an EFU zone, that number accumulates up to a maximum of 10. Okay, unless you're within the urban growth boundary, and then it only goes up to a maximum of 5. If you're non-EFU, it's a maximum of 5 times. Okay, now, I'm not sure the intention of the way that the language at the bottom of page 14 and top of page 15 was, I'm not sure what the intention here was, but the way it's written, it says that the if you fail to meet the gross income test, okay, in EFU zone farmland, okay, and the gross income test under this situation here would be $500, if you fail to make that, then you will have additional tax extended against the land equal to the number of years that you failed to meet the gross income test. All right. Well, if you don't make the income test, you're going to get thrown off of farm use assessment. So it's going to be 1 year. So the amount of additional tax that will be due will be 1 year. Rather than currently, if you've been on, say, 5 years, it would be 5 times. Or if you've been on 10 years, it would be 10 times. Okay. So I'm not sure what the intention here is, but the way it works out, you'll significantly reduce the amount of additional tax potential that's available there.
Sir Stargis?
The enforcement of existing law, 308-399, subsection 1, is really the relevant part. Is that correct? Is the problem that we're just not keeping close tabs on people who turn farmland into country estates? Is that the problem?
I'm not sure what you mean by problem.
I don't know. Now you're penalized if you take the land out of farmland use under current law.
Correct, yeah. They call it the additional tax.
Right, the additional tax or the penalty or whatever you want to call it. Okay. I guess what I'm asking is how is it determined if you take it out of farm use?
If you stop farming it.
Okay, and
that's out of farm use. Or if you use it for rural residential property, that's
the local assessor who makes that determination.
Yes.
And so what we're doing is adding on top of that now another requirement, that's the gross income test.
Correct, yeah. In EFUs now, all you have to do is make an attempt to farm it, and you'll qualify for the special farm use assessment taxation.
How often have assessors, to your knowledge, actually gone out and assessed this additional tax? Does it happen very often?
Yeah, it happens. I don't have the numbers with me now, but I think a couple years ago about $3.5 million worth of additional taxes were collected. That's both non-EFU and EFU zone. So there are lands that are being taken out and these additional taxes paid.
From what you know, are there people out there who should be paying an additional tax that aren't?
We get an assessor before that. Could you come on up?
Mr. Mason.
But was he up early?
No.
This additional tax is a one-time charge. See, when they take the land out of farm use, then they get this one-time additional charge. And it used to be they kept track of the back taxes. And this additional tax now is sort of a replacement for keeping track of the back taxes and then adding up all the benefit you receive. Okay, and then charging you one time for it. Once you're off farm use, then you go your property is on at market value, and you pay taxes on that from then on.
Okay. Well, that's Mr. Bain then.
Well, my question was how well enforced, and I'm asking a county assessor, how well enforced is the existing law of going out and assessing the additional tax on farmland that is no longer used as farmland?
Senator and Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is William Bain, Director of Assessment and Taxation, Lane County, representing Oregon State Association of County Assessors. The rules are fairly precise, and if you're asking, are we aware of the properties, do we have a program which inspects the properties on some kind of a routine basis and disqualifies those which have come to our attention not by notice from the property owner? Yes, we do. We obviously don't probably catch 100% of them every year, but in most cases, the property owner is aware of the special classification of the land, and they themselves notify us in many cases. Those in the unzoned area, or the non-EFU zoned area, for example, have to submit an income test. The property has to meet the income test, and so in the absence of that income test, that's an automatic tipper, so we go look at those. The EFU is quite a different sort of a thing. In the zoned farm, EFU zoned areas, there it's not an income test, and there it's usually that we look, and if, for example, the property owner says he's grazing the property and there are no fences up, then you scratch your head and you wonder how he grazes it because the cattle can't stay on it or the sheep. But that's the kind of thing we look for.
Is there any equivalent to by way of a farm management plan that's required, say, analogous to what's required for small woodlots?
No, not really.
Do you think that would be a good idea, and would that help you in your enforcement?
I think there's a feeling that something along that line would be helpful.
So that you could judge by some plan filed with your office or any county assessor's office whether or not the property was being used according to the plan?
Senator, I think the best answer to that is I think assessors would feel uncomfortable trying to judge whether or not the property was being used in an agricultural thing, just as we would be uncomfortable trying to determine what kind of stocking is really required for forestry. We depend on the forestry people to indicate what those requirements are. I think we would be happier if there were some tests that either was very precise so that we could tell, or that there was some other agency that got involved in that particular issue. That's kind of apart from your question, perhaps, but...
Don't you have to make that judgment now, though, and just how precise are the criteria by which you judge? You said you go out and look, and the fellow says that he's grazing, but there aren't any fences up, so you scratch your head. I mean, how...
Well, we then proceed, and I presume... I've got some farmers in Lane County, for example, that may graze the property part of the year, and they may have taken the fence down for some reason. And so long as they've grazed it and can prove that they grazed it and have a contract on hand that says I rented this particular property, so-and-so. But they are a bit inexact. For example, you could go out and intensively try to grow grass to sell the hay and not meet the income test. And similarly, you could go down and casually buy a calf at the auction and bring it back and run it on the place. You get it off the trailer and put it back on the trailer and say you raise the calf on there and sell the calf and meet the income test. So there's a bit of an inconsistency.
I'll tell you what I'm driving at. Suppose that we did not enact the income test.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose we took that out of the bill. But we're looking for a better way to enforce existing law that would protect farmland, that would keep people from, or that would be a great disincentive for people to go out, say they're going to farm 5 acres in EFU, and then turn out not to farm it. And what enforcement mechanism, what penalty is the most effective, other than something aside from the income test? And I guess I'm asking somebody who's in the field all the time, seeing these operations.
Senator, of course, I'm an assessor in a fairly large county, and I have a farm appraiser who does those kinds of things, and he could probably give you a real good answer, but I'm an engineer from Oregon State, not a farmer from Oregon State. I really don't have a good answer for you, Senator. I'd be pleased to see if I can find some answers and bring it back to you.
I'd like an opinion from the office. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, get in.
Okay, there's a couple more significant things here. At the top of page 16, section 23 repeals ORS 308.404. That particular section was tries to deal with the problem of when a farm fails to meet the income test. Now, currently, if you're non-EFU zoned and you fail to meet the income test, then you are taken off farm use assessment, and the additional tax is then levied against your property, and it comes up on the next tax bill. So if you've been in non-EFU zone for 5 years, you're going to pay the 5 times the benefit in the most recent year. That's the maximum. And you're going to need to pay that and then on the next property tax bill. This section allowed for an abatement of that additional tax if you continue to use the property in farm use. So if you continue to use the property in farm use for 5 years, you would have abated the entire amount of the additional tax. In other words, you wouldn't have had to pay the additional tax. But your property would have been during that time on the market value, on a market value. Okay, and so here you're repealing that section. So that I thought that was a significant part. Now, section 24 deals with the sort of the phase in this program. Earlier, I said that now you're going to have two classes of property on farm assessment, the EFU currently, and then the marginal agricultural lands. And section 24 deals with the phase out of all the other lands that won't be in the marginal category. And basically what it does is gives them until 1987 to either be put in an EFU or marginal lands or to get off the program. And in line 16 and 17, it says no additional taxes or penalties shall be imposed for land that's disqualified because it doesn't end up being zoned for farmland. Okay. So in this section, you're forgiving the additional taxes on that farmland that that won't be zoned. Okay. So that could amount to quite a bit of money there.
Yeah, this is going back. I'm trying to remember how the current income test on non-farm goes from 500 up to 2,000, right? And it goes by acres.
It's the minimum 500, and then from if you have acreage between 5 acres and 20 acres, it's $100 an acre.
Okay.
And then and at 20 acres, you got 2,000, and then anything over that 2,000 is the maximum that you're required to meet. So those are some of the changes, and some of these can be very significant, especially the, I'm not sure the impact of this marginal lands.
How many lands? Are you able to get some idea of that for us, or is that going to...
Boy, the way it's defined, it's going to be very difficult, especially the way marginal lands is defined, it has so many conditions that are required that you have it can be part of a farm that has $20,000 of gross income.
Can you get us some statistics on the number of individuals who are currently receiving non-EFU zone farm assessment?
I can get that breakdown.
Okay. Is there any other questions for Mr. Pearson? Thank you very much. Mr. Benner, do you have anything to add?
No.
Okay. Cliff Kanegi?
Are you on 237 now?
Yes, we are. You were one of the people we didn't get to. I guess you were the only person we didn't get to last time.
That happened twice to me, but that's
twice.
All right.
Senator Kitzhoffer, there's one other gentleman in the back who we promised could be on first.
Okay. You need to let me know that before
okay.
I...
Sorry.
Okay, we'll have him up right after Mr. Kanegi.
I am Cliff Kanegi, 1911 Northeast Pax, Corvallis, Oregon. I speak from the perspective of a full-time family farmer who is about ready to retire and hoping to phase out and turn it over to his kids. Because there was an adequate time for my testimony at the last two hearings, I would like to respond to the agendas of those sessions as well as today's. Non-farm housing. I see this as a most important aspect of this bill. Our so-called exclusive farm use zone has a built-in contradiction. It is called exclusive, but permits many exceptions, the worst of which is non-farm housing. The criteria used in permitting these are based on two false assumptions. One, that some land unsuitable for raising crops is not needed on a farm. This is false. These areas are needed for the placement of buildings, feedlots, storage of machinery, etc. One liability on my farm is that I have not had any of these poor soil areas upon which to locate these needed activities. I've been forced to use my excellent cropland for non-crop purposes. The current generation farmers may not be utilizing all of these, but the industry needs them all in order to provide flexibility for the next generation. False assumption number two is that the non-farm resident can be non-interfering. Just because it will not cause certain kinds of interference doesn't mean that it is free from others. For example, how far does a dog roam at night? Or a non-farm resident may not find my current cultural practices offensive, but what if my operation found it desirable to intensify by putting a modern hog operation up? How far do those smells go on a windy day? My family operation is already locked out on this option. We are looking for ways not to expand the land base, but to intensify on the land we have in order to provide an income for at least two and possibly four of our children who want to take over as I retire. We are already encroached upon to such an extent that in no way could we risk such an investment. We are stuck with a handicap. Our flexibility is reduced, therefore we will always be at a disadvantage in competing with the more fortunately located farmers. Or how far do kids roam? One of the biggest scares I've had was to find a kid buried to his chin in a stack of baled hay that tumbled on him. His two friends were frantically, but in vain, trying to dig him out. I have experienced vandalism also, but that has been minor compared to these other more innocent type of problems. One of the most discouraging things I find as a farmer wanting to support their land or planning process is to hear county planners react negatively to this bill. However, this is understandable if you consider that planners are trained for urban planning. There is no university, at least in this state, with the Department of Rural Planning or Resource Management. These planners are trained for urban situations. When it comes to planning for the agricultural community, they fit like a square peg in a round hole. How else can you account for them promoting the asinine concept of splitting off farm homesteads under the guise of assisting a retiring farmer? The retiring farmer may be the occupant for a few years, but what happens when he moves away or is deceased? Here I would like to refer you to Appendix A, which is testimony I presented in 1979 to the Senate Agricultural and Natural Resources Committee. I won't read that, but if you have further interest in it, you can read that at your leisure. The $20,000 income test for a farm dwelling on a small parcel is both needed and not needed. It is not needed because any bona fide farmer who has only enough money for an undersized lot and building cost will simply not build. Instead, he'll put all his money in additional land and or farm equipment. The $20,000 is needed to screen out the non-farmer. People have alleged that a $20,000 gross income test is too high. These complaints have not come from commercial farmers. Actually, $20,000 is peanuts for a gross income test and could easily be subject to abuse. I support this criteria only reluctantly. There is always a generous amount of land zoned RR through the exception process, which is available for those who need a rural residence. You have heard concerns on this gross income criteria from Greenhill County as regards the grape industry. I am not experienced in vineyards, but it appears that again there is a problem of distinguishing what is a viable commercial grape operation for a part-time from the starry-eyed people with big visions. Perhaps we need a special zone for vineyards. However, in such a case a special, however, in case such a special zone is designated, there would need to be building protection from unsuccessful vineyards becoming candidates for breaking down into smaller parcels. The whole question of what constitutes a commercial farm operation that Goal 3 was to protect needs additional clarification. U.S. census statistics are too broad to be helpful. May I refer you to Appendix B, which is testimony I submitted at a local hearing. I'd like to read just a couple of paragraphs of that. Appendix B, if I can find that. LCDC Goal 3 mandates a minimum lot sizes in EFU zones be appropriate for the continuation of the existing commercial agricultural enterprises within the area. Singling off commercial farming in this way implies that there are ever recognized forms of farming. I offer the following as a profile of farming. Hobby farming, primarily for enjoyment and lifestyle. Profit is secondary. Living derived mostly from other sources, commitment can be either high or low. Tax farming, primarily for tax purposes. Other considerations not important. Tax benefits can be realized by investing high tax bracket income into livestock, feedlots, orchards, etc., or by merely speculating in land.